This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
It's not easy to manage a radio newsroom. There is a fine line you have to navigate through. You have to capture your audience's attention, give them enough material to help them understand a certain issue, and also help them imagine the story.
This is something we strive for every day here in BFM. And having just turned 8 last week, we know we still have a long way to go in perfecting our craft.
And to help us do that, we turn to someone with years of experience working in one of the best news organizations in the world. BFM 89.9, good morning, I'm Cheryl Kaur.
And I'm Hanif Baharuddin.
This is In Case You Missed It, the show that puts journalism and the media in the spotlight. This week, we speak to a former managing editor of NPR, John Dinges, who shares with us his experience working there and his thoughts on how to manage a radio newsroom.
But before that, we have a couple of stories from Indonesia, courtesy of Asia Calling. Rampant illegal gold mining in Lombok, and Ambon recovers from a long-standing religious conflict.
Illegal gold mining is rife across Indonesia. The big problem with these small-scale operations is mercury, a toxic heavy metal used in the extraction process, which runs into nearby rivers and waterways. From Lombok, Nicole Kirby looks at how often mercury is used and the impact it has on local communities.
Lombok's spectacular volcanic hills are lined with picturesque beaches, coconut palms and bright green rice paddy fields. But the lush landscape is often interrupted by scabs in the earth, round spaces raised of vegetation in the search for gold. In clouds of dust, miners gamble with their life in the hope of striking gold. Working with limited resources, they organise in small groups and often opt for the cheapest and fastest method. So miners often set up their operation in their homes and literally on their doorsteps. While less harmful methods are slowly being adopted, many miners still use mercury, which presents a serious health risk. Dr. Ariana Ekawanti is a medical researcher at the University of Mataram and has been studying the mining community of Seketong in the southwest of the island for more than 5 years.
But when we go to the field, we will see almost every house do the mining process, especially amalgamation. They do in their home. What we afraid about is involving children in this process, because it's home industry, so the children help their parents to do some of their work, like cracking the ore or maybe pouring the mercury.
Dr. Ekawanti says that miners even extract the gold by burning mercury in their kitchens. It means that the heavy metal seeps directly into their water supplies and the food chain, impacting the entire community.
Not only the miner will be affected, but also the people around them, like children, pregnant women, and the elderly. And we know that this community is susceptible to the toxic effect of the mercury.
When I visited the village of Seketong, I was enthusiastically greeted by an excited mob of kids. But when I asked them their ages, I was amazed by how young they seemed. Government surveys of the village revealed that 47% of school-aged children here showed signs of stunted growth, compared to 17% in the surrounding area of West Nusa Tenggara. It's unclear if there's a direct link between this stunting and the use of mercury. But studies by two NGOs, Bali Focus and the Medicus Foundation, have shown higher rates of delayed development and birth defects in areas where illegal mining is prevalent in Indonesia. Yet even when miners are aware of the risks, they can still be lured by higher wages and the possibility of a big win. Lombok miner Rian explains.
If we don't work like this, we cannot make money elsewhere. It's difficult. If we work in construction, we earn 3.80 US dollars per day. But if we work here in the mine, we earn more. Sometimes we earn 11.5 US dollars for one day. So we can eat and drink. We are not yet rich, but many people have become rich.
Campaigns to raise awareness around the dangers of mercury have had some success so far, and there are some changes. Rian told me that he and his wife now mine with potassium and carbon, using a method that's more time-consuming but safer than using mercury.
According to the people, it is too dangerous if you use mercury. So we stop. We are afraid. They are not yet sick children, but we are always cautious so that people don't become sick. This is why we stop using mercury.
But small-scale gold mining is a rapidly moving industry. When gold becomes hard to find, miners quickly move on to more lucrative areas. Awareness of the risks don't always move as quickly. That's a constant challenge, says Budi Sisilarini, the Indonesian director of NGO Pure Earth.
In our project, we have to make sure that we do not only talk with the miners, because many of them are not local people. So it is very important also to talk with the local people, to talk with the community leaders, with the local government institutions. So new people come, old people go, they move to another place, and we have to make sure that the new people are also aware about the new technique, about the mercury hazard.
In 2013, Indonesia signed the Minamata Convention to phase out the use of mercury. Even though trade and use of mercury is illegal in Indonesia, the ban is rarely enforced. In fact, mercury is now cheaper than ever and easily accessible. While some of the health effects of mercury take 5, 10 or even 20 or more years to be felt, mining villages across Indonesia are yet to experience the full impacts of widespread small-scale gold mining. For Asia Calling, this is Nicole Kirby in Lombok.
We don't really hear many stories on gold mining these days, so it's definitely cool to hear one in this day and age. It reminds me of the olden days. Anyway, the worry when it comes to mining is always issues of the side effects. We see it here with the bauxite mining too. The thing about the effect of mercury is that it takes such a long time to be detected, so people don't have a first-hand evidence of how dangerous it is long-term.
Now, according to the National Geographic, there are at least 46 suspected victims of mercury poisoning identified by doctors in Lombok. Even though the practice has been banned since 2014, nearly all small-scale miners use mercury to extract gold because it's cheaper and it's easily accessible. So it's a matter of trying to make a livelihood, but at a very dangerous cause. Can't really blame them. Just need to educate them, I guess, and give them safer alternatives.
Seventeen years ago, a religious conflict broke out in Ambon, a remote island in eastern Indonesia, and the island quickly became divided along religious lines. At that time, Ronald Reagan was only 9 years old and a commander of war, but things look very different now. Ronald now works to unite the community through an initiative called Red Home. KBR journalist Dian Kurniati spoke to him.
Itu asap di mana-mana, api di mana-mana, dan
there was smoke everywhere, fire everywhere, and a Muslim call to prayer. Church hymns were also being sung. We could hear the sounds from the headlands and see the smoke and flames.
That's 26-year-old Ronald Reagan, recalling what happened to him when conflict broke out in his hometown of Ambon in 1999. The conflict was sparked by a fight between two men, but it quickly spiraled into a religious conflict, dividing the Muslim and Christian communities. By the age of 9, Ronald was a soldier of war, making bombs to attack the enemy. He was in charge of 23 child soldiers and felt no fear, he says, only hatred.
Mohon maaf sebenarnya. Setahun itu saya sebagai
I'm deeply sorry. During that year, I became a team shooter burner, and bomber. We killed so many people in 1 year. Not just 1 year, but until 2004, when the war ended. We ate flesh and drank human blood. And until now, I still remember the people I killed in front of my eyes.
Renal fought in the conflict for the next 4 years, but his life changed when he met Pastor Jackie Munupati in 2004. Pastor Jackie, from the Maluku's Protestant Church, or the GPM, travelled to Ambon to meet children involved in the conflict. He was looking for individuals to bring to an international gathering in the Philippines, a conference about children caught up in war.
At that time, I still carried arms. I saw this man and asked, "Who is he?" "I'm Pastor Jackie Munupati from GPM," he said. "I want to take you to be something better than today." This man was crazy, but then he said, "Want to go abroad or not?" I said, "Yes. If you want to, could you tell your daily activities in Ambon and North Moluccas?" I said, "Yes, I can."
In the Philippines, Renal met with children his own age from around the world, and he told his story about what was going on in Ambon.
Back from the Philippines, I was included as a young ambassador for peace, or YAP. There, I was reconciled with the Little Jihad, one of my enemies, in a forum. At first we met, we wanted to kill each other. In fact, what the Christians thought, that all Muslims are bad, was wrong. We thought that, because we never hung out with them.
Once he returned home, Renal started to spread peace through the arts in both the Christian and Muslim villages, trying to get both sides to connect. It wasn't easy. Renal, a Christian, had to hide when he went to visit Muslim villages. But eventually his mission was a success, and his Muslim friends wanted to visit the Christian villages and vice versa. That same year, in 2004, he founded the community Red Home, a hub of creative energy.
There are painters, hip-hop artists, theater, and musical poetry. And why is it called Red Home? Because if we fight, it will only lead to war, blood, and disaster.
Initially, the community of Red Home was made up of about 20 people. But 12 years later, almost all young people in Ambon are members. One of their collaborative works is this song by the Maluku hip-hop community called Puritan. For Asia Calling, this story was produced by Diane Koniati in Jakarta.
Stories like this particular one gives you a bit of hope that humanity can change if given time and space. War is bad enough as it is, and to exploit children to fight for your cause is just downright evil. But not all hope is lost, as exemplified by the story of Ronald. We just need to make sure that we won't give up in our efforts to bring them back to the light side.
I completely agree with you, Hanif. Even the child soldiers that are being used by the Islamic State at the moment, no good will come from us prosecuting them. Yes, they have committed heinous crimes, but they are also vulnerable. Children are not born with hatred, bad intentions, or evil. It's taught to them by adults. So we need to rehabilitate these children and reprogram them. Asia Calling was produced by Kantor Berita Radio 68H in Jakarta. Up next, an ex-managing editor of NPR shares his experience working in the radio industry.
Here's a snippet from the interview.
There was a reporter who I called the Bionic Reporter, and she was from the state of Alaska, which is about as far away from Washington as you can get. We hired her. She became the White House reporter. She would do usually 2, 3, 4 pieces per day, every day, 5 days a week. She was far and away the most productive reporter in the whole news organization. Obviously, covering the White House, there's news coming out there every day, but her energy was indefatigable. That level of production cannot be replicated by everybody, but it showed what you can do with energy.
I'm Cheryl Kaur.
And I'm Hanif Baharuddin.
This is In Case You Missed It, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, this is In Case You Missed It. I'm Cheryl Kaur.
And I'm Hanif Baharuddin.
National Public Radio, or more fondly known as NPR, is a radio news organization in America that has been around since the early 1970s. When it comes to producing radio content, be it news or long form, they have set the benchmark that many aspire to, including us here at BFM.
With years of experience handling radio production, they now can be considered the master of their craft. So, how do they do it?
John Dinges is a former managing editor for news in NPR. He joins me in the studio to talk about the inner workings of a radio newsroom and some of the best practices we should aim for. So I have with me John Dinges, and let's get straight into it. Let's start with your experience with NPR. Now, NPR is a benchmark for a lot of radio stations, and it's what they aspire to be. What do you think is the formula that NPR has gotten right when it comes to radio? Is it engaging content? Is it the way the content is presented? Or is it something else entirely?
Well, the way we look at it at NPR, from the time that I started working there, and I think was right, and that is that quality production, use of sound, and absolutely impeccable mastery of facts and information. So the journalism had to be top quality. That's ethics, practices, detailed reporting, together with sound production, and that combined is radio journalism.
How did NPR adapt to the shift onto the online world?
It originally, of course, it started in 1971. When I got there in 1985, it was fairly well developed, but the audience was fairly small still. It was still about 3 or 4 million people. And by the time I left in the mid-90s, it had grown to 15 million people. So we were in a period of incredible expansion in terms of audience. We were growing in terms of reporters. We were hiring new reporters. The unique thing about NPR is that the listeners actually contribute money to the stations, and then the stations buy the programming from us at NPR. So the transition to a digital media organization was, it seems fairly smooth now looking back on it, but at the time it was met with a lot of resistance. The hosts did not want to say NPR.org on the air. They didn't want to promote the digital content. It took, you know, a good decade, I would say, before you arrived at a real commitment by everybody in the organization to understand that the future of journalism, the future of radio, is a combination of everything is digital. Whether you listen over the air or whether you listen through your iPhone or on a website, it is now digital. And now it's just a matter of what platform you're using. So figuring out how to produce content and to promote that content on all the platforms is what it was all about. I think NPR was one of those that did it fairly successfully. And as we all discovered, the digital consumption of our news products just escalated online. I mean, millions and millions of people per month were listening to our content, a multiple of how many people we knew were listening to us over the air. So we had to say, something's going on here. This is going in a direction that is, we're not going to really understand for a few years, but we have to be there producing things for digital.
So at that time, was the content that NPR was putting out, was that all regional content, national content, or was that also international content as well? Because you have a large audience internationally now, including a lot of us from Malaysia as well. So how do you balance that, having something that's more national when it comes to the content? You know, for instance, now it would be the presidential race. So how do you balance that?
Well, in the United States, we're a large country with a very large international footprint. So we were always doing a lot of international coverage. Add to that the fact that we were not a local station. So at NPR News, the news organization, we did not do local coverage. The stations were located locally, and they had reporters, and they did the local coverage. So we were doing coverage in the United States, cultural coverage, a lot of politics. We prided ourselves on national politics and very, very strong international coverage. So when digital allowed us to have an international footprint and listenership, you were listening to pretty much the same kind of coverage, the same balance that we had been producing for the American audience. We didn't really add any international coverage, knowing now that we had more international listeners. And I hope this still continues to be very useful as you listen online, even from a place like Malaysia. And I guess the question is, does it sound like it's parochial U.S.-centered international news, or is it news that is useful to people outside of the United States?
So could you share some of your experience working with NPR? What is the working culture there like?
It's a wonderful place to work. I haven't worked there for 20 years, although I continue to teach radio. And the way I teach radio to my students at the Columbia School of Journalism is to train them to be in the most important radio news organization in the United States, which is National Public Radio, or the public radio system. There are various other producers. The culture of public radio journalism is one of emphasis on quality and public service. And that's really important because even though you have to make the money, you have to get the contributions, you have to have the underwriting, which is the equivalent of advertising, to survive financially, our priority was always on serving the public and providing very high quality journalism. That provides for us who are working there a great deal of inspiration because we didn't think we were a servant of anybody except the public who were listening to us.
And what is the production rate like in NPR, especially when it comes to churning out smaller capsules of news? You know, the 2 to 3 minute short analysis under the All Things Considered segment, you know, doing that on a constant daily basis, what is that like?
There was a reporter who I call the Bionic Reporter. And she was from the state of Alaska, which is about as far away from Washington as you can get. We hired her. She became the White House reporter. She would do usually 2, 3, 4 pieces per day, every day, 5 days a week. She was far and away the most productive reporter in the whole news organization. Obviously, covering the White House, there's news coming out there every day, but her energy was indefatigable. That level of production cannot be replicated by everybody, but it showed what you can do with energy. A reporter that was covering international news from Washington, so we called them diplomatic reporters, was expected to produce, at least they would have an assignment every day. Not that it was today's assignment, but over the course of the week, we knew which stories we were covering. And so that reporter would be on the air at least once a day with a piece, and then would be working at the same time on feature pieces or analytical pieces that might be longer. So at the same time you're doing daily coverage, you're working on the more in-depth coverage, longer form coverage. So everybody was working on several pieces at the same time.
And what is NPR's editorial training like?
We did more training as the years went on. In the early days, there was very little training. There was a sense of amateurism that was notable. And a lot of people were working in the newsroom who had had almost no journalistic training. A lot of the radio production training was done on the job because we didn't really come out of commercial radio, which had existed before NPR. I mean, NPR was created in 1971. So there was no place to get trained, I mean, in the kind of use of sound that we were doing. And so a lot of it was happening right there in the news organization as we were going through. When I got there, So I got there when it was 14 years old, and I took it as my task to upgrade the level of journalism. I wasn't an expert on sound, but I definitely was somebody that knew my way around the world of journalism. So I made it my business to do a lot of, call it training, a lot of staff development to make sure that our practices, our ethics, our ability to master a story was impeccable and beyond reproach. And that's important because we were attacked frequently from political sectors who would accuse us of being biased or something like that. And so we had to be able to defend ourselves by saying, look at our coverage, look at the balance, look at how we cover all sides, look at the fairness of our writing. We don't put any rhetoric in the writing. The reporters don't take an opinion. So we tried very carefully to eliminate all the signs of bias that might have been there before.
So would you say then that journalism, it's not exactly a skill that you need to go to university for? Sure, you need the groundwork maybe, but it's something where if you have a good editor who can teach you, you know, the ethics, how to do it, help you hone your skills, if you have an eye for it already, hone your skills when it comes to the news, do you think that it's more on-the-job experience versus actual university qualifications then?
Well, I'm torn a little bit.
Because you're a professor, yeah.
Because I'm a professor, so you would want me to say, oh, the only way to become a journalist, you got to go to my school and pay a lot of money to become a professional journalist. But you're looking at somebody who never went to journalism school until I began to teach journalism. So I was trained on the job at a newspaper in the state of Iowa, Des Moines, Iowa. And you mentioned that you knew Des Moines, Iowa.
I actually studied in Des Moines, Iowa, yeah.
It's a relatively small, medium-sized city in the heartland of the United States, very high educational levels, and a very good newspaper. And that newspaper trained me from scratch. I had a university education, but no journalism. And I guess maybe my English degree taught me a little bit about writing and about how to understand things. And so I was trainable. And so,
I guess I had
a certain bent toward journalism, but the training was on the job. And then I think I learned even more when I worked at the Washington Post, where the standards were even higher. And I was dealing with some of the most important journalists of the United States. And I looked up to them, and I had role models to imitate and to see how they did it and make sure that I was following their standards.
And how are newsrooms surviving in America, especially with the advent of podcasts and digital content?
Boy, that's a sad story. There are a lot of newspapers that are greatly reducing their staffs. There have been some newspapers that have closed down or gone to digital. And unfortunately, when they go to digital, they usually slash the staff by about 80%. It's kind of sad. And so what we find in the United States, particularly since 2008 when the economy collapsed, is that it's recovered to a certain extent, but jobs in news contracted by about 40% and recovered maybe half of that. And income, resources, revenue to news organizations also contracted substantially and have not really come back. Profit margins are nowhere near where they were in the 80s and 90s. And so it definitely the newspaper business, the journalism business is still under stress. I wouldn't say it's in crisis anymore. It's stable, but it's stable at a lower level than it was years before.
What about radio newsrooms particularly?
Well, radio is a good news story. I mean, radio, for some reason, is this incredibly adaptable medium. It's quite cheap to produce. You can produce a lot of content with relatively low cost, unlike television. And probably, I haven't done this analysis, but I would say much cheaper than newspapers. I mean, you can do equivalent coverage much cheaper. You don't have as many reporters. I always emphasize you need reporters on the street, talking to people, finding the stories, doing the investigation. So the more reporters you have, the better your journalism is. But radio is able to do all of that, sound really great, and there's really no reason to be afraid of the new technology as far as radio is concerned, because radio is going to sound pretty much like radio. Well, we know this, whether you hear it on your mobile or whether you hear it over the air, you hear it on your computer, it's pretty much the same product with, you know, some enhancements perhaps, but there's no reason to believe that the technology is going to be a threat to radio.
So you've had some 16 years of experience in a radio newsroom. Based on your experience, what makes a good radio newsroom?
A good radio newsroom is organized. It has a sense of its own mission, its sense of identity. It knows who it is. It knows who its audience is. And a good radio newsroom is one in which every reporter, every producer has a consciousness of serving the audience, that we're doing this for the audience, not for ourselves, not because we want to appear on the air, not because we want to be famous. Nothing wrong with being famous and important if you're a good journalist, but that we're doing this to serve the public who is listening to us. And so we have to stay very close to them, always have a consciousness of talking to them directly. One of my mentors, a newscaster at NPR, who's now quite old at this point after many, many years, but he used to say that whenever he was in front of the microphone, he would imagine that he was talking to his Aunt Martha. Aunt Martha was a college-educated woman who he saw as from the, I don't know where she was from, upstate New York or something like that, you know, not from New York or Los Angeles. He always envisioned this to be the typical NPR listener, intelligent, interested, curious, not a power broker, not a politician, not even necessarily an academic, but somebody who is curious and intelligent and who wants to hear the story and understand the story that you're telling. So with that person in front of you, tell the story. That was what he told me. When you think of Aunt Martha, that puts you in the mindset of a conversation rather than a speech. So if you're thinking of a demographic, how can you have a personal relationship with a demographic? You can't. So you will come across as some disembodied, intellectual, maybe academic-sounding person. Nothing wrong with academics, says me, of academics.
An academic.
But you don't want to come across as disembodied and thinking abstractly or talking abstractly. So always keep that face in front of you. Because after all, think of it from the point of view of the audience. Every person in the audience is listening to you as an individual. They are one person, and you are communicating. Even though you have a million listeners, you're talking to them one person at a time.
So, like any other medium, the radio news has many challenges, particularly when it comes to the radio newsroom. Now, most people consume broadcast news when they're in the car or while they're doing something. So it's not really something that's their primary focus. It's kind of in the background and they don't give it their full attention. How does a radio station deliver content that is succinct and digestible?
Well, I'm not somebody who believes that because radio is a medium consumed on the go, that we therefore should make everything really short and succinct and short, simple sentences and all that sort of things. We know that most people listen to the radio in the car or while they're taking a shower or, you know, getting ready for the workday. But there's a concept we call the driveway moment, which is a radio story that captures the listener so much that when the listener and his car or her car arrive home and your story is still on the air, they won't open the door and go into the house because they want to keep listening until the end of the story. Those are not short, succinct, you know, little bitty stories. These are stories that develop a narrative line that compel you to listen. And that's what we strive for, even in a news story, something that is so compelling that I won't want to stop I may have been distracted when I started listening, but the story captured me, and now I'm paying attention. We won't pay attention equally to every story, but we want to always accomplish this grabbing the listener through the power of the sound, through the power of the information and the talent of the reporter and the voices that you put on the air, so that the person listening really wants to listen to what you're talking about.
So there's this famous saying that goes, radio is the theater of the mind. What are your thoughts on that based on your experience, especially for heavy content like the news, which does not really have that much room where you can be abstract with it?
No, radio is a very concrete medium. And not that you can't talk about abstract ideas. I think of radio as the most visual of the mediums. It is the medium that uses imagination most creatively. So theater of the mind is a good way of capturing that same idea. But what do you mean by that? You mean that when you're listening to the radio, you're not given the visual cues unless the writing and the voices that you hear provoke an image in your head. So good radio writing creates images in your imagination. And those images are visual images. And really well done radio will put you in a place and it will create a movie or a work of theater in your mind. I often describe a piece of journalism, even if it's a news piece, as a work of theater, as a play. It has three acts. It has a beginning, middle, and an end. It has multiple voices, and it occurs in a particular place. And it follows the chronology of a story. So you can think of really good radio as pieces of theater.
So in this day and age of digital media, is radio still a relevant platform? What can or should it do to remain relevant aside from streaming its content online?
I think we should be neutral on that question. We're not here to preserve radio. We're here to serve people. And if radio's a really relevant and good way to serve the public, and that includes enhancing democracy, then radio will continue to be relevant. I think it will be for a long time, but I'm not trying to figure out ways to make radio different so that it's going to continue to be relevant. I'm more concerned with what's the best way that journalism will continue to be relevant and strengthen societies. I think that radio is now and will be for the foreseeable future a crucial part of that mix of mediums that will support societies, free societies. I don't think it's going to go away. I don't think there's any reason we should be worried about it going away. Who knows what's going to come in 15 or 20 years, but what is more basic to humankind, to human interaction, than the human voice? And radio is the quintessential expression of the human voice.
That was John Degas, former managing editor of NPR. This morning's show was produced by Hanif Bahruddin and me, Cheryl Kaur. To download the podcast, head on over to bfm.my/icymi.
I hope it's been food for thought. And remember, the price of liberty is eternal vigilance.
This is In Case You Missed It, BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.